Right, the last, hopefully, the last attempt at things you're supposed to know before we go on and do more stuff. And that is, words, and you've done all the words, hopefully, and we'll print them out for anyone who does need them all. We're at, and then we looked at cell structure. So, you need to know the general structure of plant, animal, and bacterial cells. So, we look at a plant cell. That's a classical plant cell picture, hopefully one that you've seen before. You may not have seen plasmodesmata, which are the connecting together plates. That's these. But plant cells have got cell walls and a big and lots of reticulated reticulum. Not a good laser. Okay. They've got large vacuoles. The vacuoles deal with the fact that plant cells can't change the shape of their shape. They have a nucleus. They have chloroplasts and mitochondria. Chloroplasts and mitochondria together are important because chloroplasts and mitochondria may once have been bacteria that have symbiotically been taken on by cells for chloroplasts to symbiotically make food, and for mitochondria they increase the efficiency of respiration. So there's an appearance that they may once have been free living organisms. One of the pieces of evidence for this is, of course, that they all have their own genomes. The mitochondrial genome, so they've got their own DNA, and it's a circular piece inside a body like this. Chloroplasts also have genome. I think the battery's rather slow in that. Okay, that's plant cells. Animal cell, different shape, and we do plant animal cells. When we do them in year 9, you can usually see that a lot of animal cells are smaller than plant cells. They don't have a regular shape, and they don't have chloroplasts in them. They don't have a cell wall. Bacterial cell do have cell walls and other things on the outside. Bacterial cell walls are different from plant cell walls, and that's one of the things to remember. Plant cell walls are made of cellulose. Bacterial cell walls are made of peptidoglycan.
What holds the animal
cell? Cell membrane. Animal cells are obviously, they've got to use some other thing for structure. Plant cells build themselves one cell at a time, and basically how much water's in them is what gives them the hydraulic sort of structure. You have got bones. And we get stuff like skin on the outside, which is impervious. But there's no separate organelles inside a prokaryotic cell. It's got a big coil of DNA. It's called nucleoid, and occasionally it's called the nucleosome. But effectively there's a single circular chromosome. Now it's coiled up again in there. But the chromosome is just one DNA circle. They have little bits of extracellular DNA, which we haven't shown on this picture. Little tiny circles called plasmids. The thing that bacteria can do that's scary in some ways is that they can exchange plasmids across species. So what's here is pili can be used for connecting to other bacteria, and they transfer genetic information, and it's not species specific. Kieran?
I assume that's like, is that a bacteria? It's not like a cooperative, but it's one taking advantage of the other. Is that correct? Or what? So, I mean, there's no advantage of giving away a useful plasma to another species.
No, but I think there may be I don't know the answer.
Okay.
There may be something along the lines of pollination where you hope that in a large colony, you're likely to be giving it to the same species, and if you accidentally give it to another one, that's no skin off your nose as a species.
Yeah. So they deliberately release plasmids?
I don't know about deliberately releasing plasmids, but they do actively actively move them from one bacterium to another. What happens is you get antibiotic resistance is often found on plasmids. If a plasmid with a bacterial resistance gene gets transferred from some intestinal bacterium that you've got that's just living in your gut to a pathogenic bacterium, that's potentially bad. It's one of the reasons that some people are very, very concerned about the fact that they've, the sort of last line of defence antibiotic was called vancomycin. And a number of people expressed some concern about the fact that people were feeding this to chickens, just to prevent chickens from getting infection so that you could increase your chicken production. However, just vancomycin-resistant bacteria in chicken manure has got the potential to horizontally transfer the genes to other bacteria. If there's vancomycin resistance present in the environment, then it can get into bugs that you can get infected with. And then no antibiotic will cure it. You have to rely on your immune system. Yeah. And that's back to what things were like before antibiotics were invented, back at the turn of the 19th century. I mean, my grandmother trained as a nurse back in those days, and, you know, your weapons were boiling water and sunlight soap. And, you know, sponging people's brow to keep a fever down, you try and keep any other bugs away as much as possible, and you keep, you know, you concentrate on nutrition and fever management. We've got very, very sloppy with antibiotics because you can simply give people a pill and they get rid of an infection. The reason that antibiotics work is that prokaryotic organisms are really, really different from eukaryotes. So if you take a drug that kills them, the chances are that chemical won't interact with a part of your, as a eukaryote, cell biology. And truthfully, the thing here, ribosomes, bacterial ribosomes are different from eukaryotic ribosomes. So they've been drug targets, because ribosomes do protein synthesis. And so they've got different sized ribosomes, so you can attack them. Cell wall has been a thing that you can attack, because chemically, the bacterial cell wall, we don't have anything like that. That being said, we can't digest it either, and bacteria live quite happily in all parts of our gut. And that's straight, you know, that tagline, you know, lovely to see you all. When you walked in here, only 10% of the cells you brought in were human. 90% of the cells that you carried in were non-human. And they've started to find that there's a fair number of genomes in there that are unique and that nobody suspected, and that your bacteria, you tend to get from your mother, and that individual people's bacterial populations are different. Which is one of the reasons that sharing spit's a bad thing, because bacteria are living quite happily in community in your throat might be different from those who live in somebody else's throat, and a bacteria that doesn't cause you any harm because of its neighbours may, in somebody else, grow out of control. Here.
So, just a question on my line of bacterial population. Bacterial population living within a person.
Yep.
Well, when does a newborn baby
is born sterile? Yes.
Born sterile. Okay. And then they collect their bacteria from their immediate environment.
Yeah, mothers.
Yeah.
That's my understanding. Yeah, immediate okay. environment, and they start to grow in that fashion. And well, I think it has to be relatively non-dangerous.
Yeah. Okay.
However, I think also because our bacterial population is necessary, for those of you who have any complications whenever you take antibiotics, most of those complications are digestive. They are. You get real digestive upset because your bacterial population has been disrupted by antibiotics and killing the bad ones and killing the good ones as well.
So if you're born in a sterile environment and then you get bacteria that are real, like clean and stuff, that keeps the sterile environment?
No, it doesn't, because you're getting your food's not completely sterilised, and bacteria reproduce awfully fast.
Yep.
And there's some estimates, and I haven't done enough work on this recently, but there's some estimates you've got about sort of a kilogram, 1.2 kilos of bacteria in your body.
Some of it's good.
Most of them are good. It's a scary number. They're almost regarded as another organ system, a symbiotic. I mean, humans are ecosystems. If your ecosystem gets out of whack, you start to develop other things, like fungal infections, for example, because the bacterial competition disappears. But they also digest stuff, make things, some of their waste products are good for us. they are produced in large quantity, and that's, you know, if we talk about the jobs not to have in science, one of those is the person who discovered that 50% of the dry weight of bacteria was 50% of the dry weight of human feces was bacteria. It's the dry weight. That's one of the reasons why people on hunger strike continue to defecate. Bugs and intestinal mucosa. It's a nice way of saying the. No, you keep you're growing actually from the inside out, so the outside layer always comes off. It's like house dust is skin. It's the same thing. One of the reasons it's doing is just reducing damage by abrasion. The outside layer does come off. Always a good thing. Okay. Organelles. So if we've looked at the general structure of plant, animal and bacterial cells, you also need to know what the bits are and what they do. When I said that cell biology was a requirement for doing year 13 bio, this is the bit. And it's mostly so that you've got some sort of intrinsic understanding of it. So if we're talking about proteins being made, we know that they're made on ribosomes. If they're secretory proteins, they're made on ribosomes on the endoplasmic reticulum. The proteins are sent through the endoplasmic reticulum and modified, packaged in the Golgi for export. Yeah. So for Alex, we'd expect that to be flying way over the top. For the rest of you, it shouldn't be. So, the quick tour, we hope. See if I've done anything. Oh, no, I didn't put it in. Ah! Yes, it did. Right. Cell nucleus. The nucleus is the control centre of the cell, which is the year 12 definition. It's got a membrane. Things to know about it. It's got a Oops, go back. Back. Okay. It's got a membrane. They've called it the nuclear envelope in this picture. Inside the nucleus is chromatin. That's DNA and the supporting protein structures and stuff. They've also got the nucleolus. People like the nucleolus because it's stained dark in pictures when they first started looking at them. It's regarded as a site of RNA synthesis, but yeah, that's the last we hear about it. Chromosomes, they're shown in condensed form here. We're going to go into what they're made of a little bit more in a minute. And nuclear pores. Nuclear pores are ways that stuff gets out of the nucleus, because it's important that stuff gets out of the nucleus. In the nucleus is the information, out of the nucleus is where stuff gets made, where stuff happens. So, in the nucleus, all of the DNA is kept. DNA is transcribed into message, and the message sent out through the little nuclear pore that's got little, like, six-fold symmetry proteins around the side which guard the pore so that stuff gets. There's some control over what goes in and out. Okay. We've also got some other pictures of the nucleus. Nucleus, really from what you need to know, nucleus has got DNA in it. That's the point. It's got the chromosomes in it. When chromosomes replicate in something like mitosis or meiosis, the nuclear membrane breaks down, and that happens, the whole cell gets taken over while that's going on, and then new cells get made. Other little parts connected, spindle fibres and centrosomes. Okay, there's some pictures of chromosomes. That's a nice classically picture of a condensed one. You can see that it looks hairy. Hairy is important because what this is DNA. If we think that our cells are really, really small. If our cells are really, really small, inside the cell is a nucleus, and inside the nucleus are the 46 chromosomes. There's enough DNA in there, each cell nucleus, theoretically, to stretch it from the floor to the top of the door. Now, it's about 10 nanometers thick, or thereabouts, it's either 10 or 30. Nanometers thick and 2 meters long. Keeping that organised is a huge job. And so it's coiled up in the double helix, and then the double helix is coiled around again and coiled around and coiled around. And I'm not sure if any of you have been in any class. Connor might have been. I think you were in year 11. Anyone who's seen Year 11, in Year 11, one of the things that I've done with it before is you can make DNA out of string. And it's a way of keeping irritating people occupied for a while. If you stretch the string corner to corner, make two strands, then you can colour in some genes with a bit of crayon, and then people's job is to twist it. So you put one person holding it and the other person twisting it. And if you twist it for a whole period, you end up with a string that goes from being 15 metres long to being about this big. And it's multiply coiled. As soon as you get the first thing, as soon as it starts to coil too much, you get a double coil on a coil and it starts to form another little loop and it coils itself up. And then you keep doing it, the little coils start to breed and you get what's called supercoiling. You coil it too much and it coils, and then it supercoils, and then you coil it some more and it supercoils. And I have ended up with a piece that's about, it's a little bit bigger than my fist, from two bits of string, the length of the class ring. You should try it with a wee piece. Call it a homework assignment. Try it with a wee piece. If you do it 10 metres long, you're twisting for at least 25 minutes, which isn't always useful use of time unless you're doing something dull. Tie it onto something and twist it one way. Just put a pencil through it and twist it. But colouring it in with a crayon is quite good because you can say, okay, the purple bit is a gene, the red bit's another gene, green bit's another gene, and you can actually see them if they coil up. But the picture that we've got here has got little hairy bits sticking out, which are the supercoils. Now, in a real chromosome, it's also coiled around histone proteins, where there's a skeleton that it's coiled about. So it's more, it's not just coiling it up so it randomly supercoils it together. It's coiling it around a frame, like winding up fishing line. You can store it in a really organised place, say, okay, I want reel number 15, and we could pull out reel number 15 and unravel it. Jonas? I don't think so. Because one of the things is that when it's being dealt with, there are enzymes that uncoil it. The easy way to do it is that they cut, you nick it. So you take they take the coiling strain off, you nick a piece, you put an enzyme in, the enzyme then separates the two strands and runs along. What happens with the chromosome is that what we see, that X-shaped thing, isn't, it's how it works out when it's replicating. That's not what it looks like when it's actually making hair colour pigment. Then the thing's a whole lot more spread out, and the piece that it's using does unravel, gets unravelled and separated by enzymes and gets copied. So that's basically packaging for cell division. Now, the colour painting on the chromosomes, you know, I said that this is a karyotype. They originally used to take photographs of chromosomes and cut them out and line them up so that the big ones were, and you can see chromosome 1 is the biggest, chromosome 2 is the next biggest. So they're organised by size and by the position of the centromere. Now again, I'm not sure how functional that is. I don't think it's very functional. It's the traditional way that they're organised, so we can count them up. We can count them up and go, this picture here is of a boy, normal male, because it's got an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. And you can see that the X chromosome is about similar in size to sort of chromosome 12. It fits somewhere in this, like, high, maybe it's even bigger than that. Yeah, it's almost chromosome 5. So the chromosomes are organised by some kind of structural method. Painting the fluorescent colour dyes on them is, it's a technique called FISH. I am being entirely serious. FISH, fluorescence in situ hybridisation. But I suspect the acronym was actually chosen so that it made a nice story as well. So chromosome painting here is called FISH. What, I mean, it's got a grand tradition. And we can't see the ones under there. I might, underneath, there's another like banding thing. When you look at old black and white karyotypes, you know, there's black and white bands on them. That's where dye sticks. It's back to chromosome, the coloured thing you saw down the microscope. Those bands don't have any real meaning either, but they do occur in the same place on the chromosome, and they do allow you to map how far the things are away. but they are a function of the replicated dividing chromosome, not necessarily a function of how it makes stuff. Shelby. No. DNA testing is something completely different.
Okay.
We'll get there. Sometime, hopefully, before the end of June. Seriously, genetics is a big topic. That's biotech. The cool thing about DNA is it's a chemical and you can just play with it. It's really tough, really stable. You can heat it up and cool it down, and we'll do a whole lot of this sort of stuff, but you can do it. It's and set up in machines. So DNA testing, now you can pretty much put it in a machine and get the sequence at the other end, and then get the computer to read the sequence. And the email I was doing at the very beginning was Kay Wilson, who's a demonstrator in the biochem department, so hopefully we're getting to go and at least run a gel, do a little bit of separating. We only spent half a day down there.
Yeah.
Biochem department in the mid-semester break. Okay. Hopefully we're going to go down there and we do some of the biotech stuff, because they do it all the time. For us, it would be an investment of some thousands of dollars for something we'd use once.
Yeah.
And we'd always forget from one year to the other the one time that we have to do it. So, we do it down there. So, that's what chromosomes look like when they're dividing. That's not what chromosomes look like when they're working. Yep. Okay, there's a bit more of a picture. You see the replicated chromosomes, the X-shaped things? There's two copies of a chromosome in there, which is why we call them chromatids. So, half of each chromatid is a whole chromosome. It's been replicated, so there's two copies, so that in mitosis they then get separated out. And you need to keep thinking that chromosomes are made of DNA. The 46 chromosomes contain the 2 meters of that stuff. Kieran. No, it's a chromosome all the time. This thing about a replicated chromosome is made of fruit. Yeah. Again, we're dealing with the fact that we've got a whole lot of history because people identified all this just by looking at them without knowing anything about it. It's sort of analogous to Lavoisier identifying oxygen. So Lavoisier identified oxygen and showed that it had all the unique properties of oxygen, and oxygen was what we breathed and what got taken out of the air when we breathed. But he didn't believe in atoms. Nasty newfangled theory, won't come to anything. That was one of two major pieces of misjudgment he made. The other was his choice of work, which meant that discovering oxygen was sort of the end, because he collected taxes for the French government just before the revolution. Therefore, he was somewhat shorter after the revolution and didn't work anymore. Yeah. He met that very famous French woman, Madame Guillotine. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of analogous to that. Mendel did all of his stuff about genetics without knowing anything about what genes were. Chromosomes, they found a whole lot. They're down there. We can see them. When cells are dividing, they go through the process of mitosis. We can identify them. We can classify them. We just don't know what the hell they are or what they do. So the big thing in biology is having found out what they do, giving us some tools to deal with it. Okay, there's a picture of a chromosome and a whole lot of other stuff. There's the banding pattern and the things we need to know about chromosomes. There's a centromere. There's a little waist thing. Above the centromere is the P arm. Below the centromere is the Q arm. Usually the centromere is always slightly asymmetric. Or whichever way it's drawn is the top. Yeah, nothing here is anywhere near what we need to deal with. Down the back is a picture from, I think, Nature and NIH, which has got a whole lot of genes found on chromosomes, how many bases there are in a chromosome, the big poster. How many genes there are in a chromosome, and a whole lot of stuff about what genetic diseases you can find on there. The blue traces are the crest of the number of genes you found on them. So there's 23 chromosomes, 15 to 20,000 genes. So, you know, that's a bit under 1,000 genes per chromosome. That's actually they're pretty spaced out. If you think about how big they are in terms of how big the thing actually is. Chromosomes are huge. So an awful lot of it appears to be non-coding. We'll get onto that sometime before June. Okay. They've got map units for like how far away it is from the centromere. But yeah, P's and Q's, minor your P's and Q's, isn't really important, but I just thought we'd go. That's not even the far end of chromosome research. It's a field that's going really, really crazy. Ooh. Okay, underprepared PowerPoint slide. Yeah, okay. If we put them in there, though, control center of the cell contains chromatin. Chromatin, I'm talking about what, Matt? It's the control center of the cell and it contains chromatin. What am I talking about? The nucleus. Okay? I'm talking about something in the center of the cell that creates ribosomes. What is it, Connor? Matt, tell him. It's the nucleolus. Okay. Contains the genetic code to make you who you are. During cell division, it will shorten to make DNA. Oh, that's not nice. Anyone guessing? Chromatin. Outer layer of the nucleus, controlling what will enter and leave the nucleus. Ellie. That wasn't bad. That was nearly a possum in the headlights. What part of the nucleus are we talking? The nuclear membrane. Okay, the nuclear membrane. When we're talking about controlling what goes in and out, it's the membrane thing. And a part of the thing is there's almost a almost continuous sort of membrane. Like back in the days when I studied biochemistry, there was a theory called membrane differentiation and flow. The membrane started being made of the nucleus and became endoplasmic reticulum, rough, then became smooth endoplasmic reticulum, then wandered off to the Golgi, and little vesicles came out and popped onto the plasma membrane and became new plasma membrane. And I haven't tracked where the theory goes, but yeah, there's almost contiguous membrane through the inside of the cell. Yeah, no, I think battery's not doing very well. Okay. A large thing in the plant cell which adds structure. Vacuoles. Transports proteins made in the ribosomes to the Golgi. Endoplasmic reticulum. Reticulum is Latin, I think, for plumbing. Reticulation is all plumbing. So reticulum. The plumbing system. Packages proteins and other materials transported from the ER. Mr. Golgi's thing. Okay, created in the nucleolus, produces proteins is the ribosome. Okay, cleans up the cell from broken down, worn out cell parts. Lysosome. Okay, containing lytic enzymes. Lysosomes are little balls of destructor enzymes that zoom around and break stuff down. The sort of cells that eat bugs will eat one, and then the lysosome will stick on and they'll digest everything that's inside the little membrane. So there's some very cool bits and pieces with this. Okay, found only in plant cells. We actually won't spend any more time on that because I'm embarrassed by it. Okay, so parts of the cell we need to know. Oh, cytoskeleton. I'll print the whole thing out. Tubey things inside. Yeah, if you think about what you don't usually see much about what the cytoskeleton does. The cytoskeleton is things like what the chromosomes move along when they're being separated out. Spindle fibers are part of the cytoskeleton. So anything that requires anchoring inside an animal cell, especially, is cytoskeleton based. And some people really like microtubules. Oh, we're doing it again. Excellent. Oh, that was nice. We should have done that one before we did the other one. Okay. Yeah, Alex, do you want to write it or do you want me to print it? Okay, fine, that's cool. Okay, so we've talked about chromosomes, the things that contain genetic information, made of DNA. There's a set number per species. That's good. So let's just think, just the set number per species. Humans have got 23 pairs. Kieran. Yeah. Yeah, plants, it's possible to get that to happen with plants, and we've got, it's one version of that. The other one is the easy version of plants. It seems to be much easier to mess with chromosome number in plants. If we think about ordinary plants, I mean, ordinary organisms are diploid. Diploid means two copies of each chromosome. Some plants have other odd numbers. Some of them are triploid. Three copies. Wheat, ordinary bread wheat, hexaploid. So it's got six copies of each chromosome. Now, should I answer a question by asking another question? Have any of you ever heard anybody complain about the fact that modern fruit or vegetables don't taste the same as they used to? Polyploidy in plants is one of the ways in which you can make plants bigger without sort of having to give them fertilizer and things. If you give them a double set of chromosomes, the cells are a bit bigger, and there's a chemical called colchicine, which we certainly used to play with quite a lot when I was at school, putting it on things to see what it did to put the replication, that will let the doubling happen in meiosis, but stops the cell division, the next cell division happening. So you get a double set of chromosomes, which needs a bit more nucleus, and needing a bit more nucleus needs a bit more rest of the cell to keep it going. So they get bigger. Polyploid plants are bigger than diploid plants. Wheat, for example, started off as being sort of grass. And if you look at the seed in grass over here, it's got little tiny wee seeds. In wheat, the seeds are much more pumped up because there's six copies of a chromosome. It's a lot bigger. It seems, though, to also make some, especially fruits, quite a lot more fragile. So wild strawberries taste amazing. The modern farm strawberry is, huge compared to a wild strawberry, but it's probably got about the same number of cells, and it's probably therefore got about the same number of flavour molecules. But also, it's actually quite hard to squash a wild strawberry, whereas if you get a strawberry this big from the supermarket, you squeeze it, you end up with two bits of strawberry and a lot of jam. Sorry. Deep question. What happens to the recessive dominant thing? The question is, what is the recessive dominant thing?
Well, then you're going to be like one dominant, like five.
Okay, well. Yeah, so you'll get a mix, is the real answer. Yeah. The question is, what happens if you get six different dominant alleles? And you do, you get six different characters being shown, because we tend to do easy ones when we're trying to look at this, like hair colour. But if you look around, everybody's got different hair colour if they're born with it, and chemically modified. But even there, without dyeing it, everyone's hair colour's a bit different. But there's a difference between coloured and not. And so dominant recessive in that case is dominant's the one that makes the dark colour. Recessive, the one that doesn't. Like, I know, looking at my heritage, that I was born with brown eyes. I'm heterozygous for eye colour. I know that because, like, I've got a child with blue eyes. So if the cells in my iris are making whatever colour makes blue and brown, what are you going to see? Brown, regardless. So that's how the dominant recessive works in a simple fashion. You're getting a protein that's seen, or that does the job properly, and potentially one that doesn't. That's part of the thing about what we've got too. With six, therefore, in theory, it's much harder to get recessive characteristics. in practice there's something more complicated because we get weird stuff with girls. Just had to hang it out there until I got some kind of response. Sex chromosomes are odd. In sex chromosomes, yeah, the old question, and this threw into, you know, other relief when we talked about Caster Semenya, South African athlete who was accused of being a man. But, and I was fascinated to discover they didn't do sex testing in the Olympics anymore. Obviously, she was sent away by the International Olympic, not the Olympic Committee, the IAAF, I think, the International, you know, Amateur Athletic Federation, or whoever, about whether she was a man or not. Because what they had trouble with was, how do you sex an athlete? I mean, you know, you can sex chickens. How do you tell if an athlete's male or female? And the answer is you open up and have a look at their cells, because looking down their pants doesn't work. Or things that look like man bits. The issue is the anabolic steroids, and I mean the kind of training thing that pushes you into that kind of environment produces, I mean, in most sports, unlike things like gymnastics and some sports which are specifically designed for female body shapes, if women are competing in stuff like shot put, the basic requirement of shot put is having long levers and really big muscles. And so if you train and you do the things to develop really big muscles, but if you take steroids, then in males, taking anabolic steroids causes things like testicular atrophy. Really bad acne, hair growing in funny places, voice deepening, and outbursts of bad temper. Testicular atrophy is the one that makes it difficult, though, because if your balls shrink, they're harder to spot. In women, anabolic steroid abuse can lead to things like clitoral enlargement. So it does, because they come from the same tissue. So you've got to have a look at the cells. And if you look at the cells, what happens in the nuclei of cells of women is that one of your X chromosomes crunches up and doesn't work, turns into a bar body. So you can actually look at male and female cells, and if you look at them and stain them with the right sort of stain, you can say girl, boy, because they've got little spots in them.
And if one of the other sex for a female crunch up, you would just know that it used to be a female, like the Y can't
crunch up. No, the Y is tiny and only really has the message that says make testicles.
Okay.
That's the only real message the Y chromosome has. Somebody found this, like, that particular gene, there's a little bit of more subtlety now in the Y chromosome, but the basic thing with the Y chromosome is that there's a piece of it that says make testicles. It's called SRY, the gene. So the difference between men and women is that gene. Guess how big it is. We've got 3 billion bases of DNA. Guess how big the thing that makes men men is. So it's got to make a protein. So it takes 3 DNA bases to make 1 amino acid. You've got to make a protein with a few things in it, right? 240 base pairs. 240 out of 3 billion is the bit that makes men and women different. And they found it because the little piece came off one. There's a particular... Chromosomes swap over during meiosis. And so they found that there was a guy who, when you looked at the chromosomes, had 2X chromosomes. With, when they look really carefully, a little 240 base bit on the bottom of one of them. And that made man bits.
2 X's,
but...
A little bit of a man bit crossed over from the Y.
Yes, and on one X chromosome, there was that gene that says make testicles.
Okay.
And if you've got testicles, you're a bloke. Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. From my understanding, yes. Yeah. Now there are some other issues. There are some other issues with that. That's also true, Jonas. Yes. Or you inject extract of. if you've seen women who have been accused of using anabolic steroids, and I think was it the Athens Olympics, the Chinese women's swim team, there was some really big, there was a really, they got really offended about it. But if you look at female swimmers who have been accused of using anabolic steroids, big shoulders, narrow waist, heavy musculature, and one of the Kiwi boys who walked past the swim team heard what he thought was a whole lot of blokes talking and turned around, and it was not blokes. So deep voice, so yeah, you can mimic it. That's why steroids are really good for women's sport. And although the allegation is unproven because the woman is dead, the world 100 and 200 metres sprint records haven't been beaten since 1984. There are a number of women's records which haven't been beaten since the 70s. And many of those women from Eastern Germany and other Eastern Bloc countries have never been able to have children, because they were taken at a very young age and sent to special schools and given special diets. And your trainer says, here, drink this, and you get really big muscles and run really fast, or throw things a really long way. Now, that's not all true, because some women have been incredible athletes. And my first memory is, I think I've told you the one about the Russian woman shot putter. It's the first time I remember seeing a picture of an Olympic athlete. And she looked like, you know, a lot of stereotypes coming out of this conversation. A peasant woman from the steppes. She had that sort of Russian peasant woman face. But wearing an athletics singlet and holding a shot put like this. Okay, so shot put, this sort of size. Shot put, my biceps don't like show up. Her biceps were two shot puts across. And wow, she must be able to throw that a really long way. It might be from generations of heavy physical labour. Who knows? Like I said, you know, the 1984 sprint records are from a woman who made a real thing about external signs of femininity, and there are some. So the allegations are, you know, as I say, unproven. She's dead. She's, I don't know, burned up, maybe. And she was certainly really fast. But, so that, I mean, that's also an effect of hormones on your body. That's sort of difficult. Okay. Nuclear membrane we've talked about. Oh, sorry, 23 pairs of chromosomes. Yeah. Anyone ever eaten seedless grapes or seedless oranges? Guess how they become seedless. Odd number of chromosomes. Ordinary oranges, yeah, this is what you're saying about. You can get oranges with three different chromosome numbers. 9, 18, 27. Guess which ones make seeds? 18. Why? Divisible by 2. You can make. So, the 9s, I'm getting a little small. The 27s are the seedless oranges that we eat. No, mandarins are different. Like, they taste different. Different skin. I'm not sure what they are. They might be blood oranges. They might be, who knows? I don't know enough about orcharding. I won't even ask you what colour a cat called mandarin might be. Yeah. Which could lead us on to tortoiseshell cats, which is back to exon activation, and yeah, you were enjoying that before. Yeah, so those things are rare. However, guess what's got more chromosomes than us? Goats! Underwater goat with snorkel and flippers. Dogs? Horses don't. Okay, the really common ones, dogs, 72 chromosomes to our 46, goldfish. I think goldfish have got over 90. Now, number of chromosomes isn't a measure of how much DNA it is. But chromosome recombination, which is what you're supposed to have done in year 12, is the thing that produces variation. Think about variation in dogs. How much variation can we get in dogs? And how much can we get in goldfish? If you look at the number of pictures of different kinds of goldfish there are, There are zillions. And hopefully I've told at least some of you the dog story. Vet in Wales used to breed pedigree boxes. Thought, as a vet, I can't ethically really justify cutting the tails off perfectly healthy puppies, but I like showing boxes. I'll make my best boxer with a tailless, naturally tailless Welsh Corgi. How many generations do you think it took him until he got show quality boxers back with no tails that looked like a boxer but had no tail from the Corgi? Five?
One.
More than one?
Three.
Three. You've heard it before. Maybe. You were probably facing the wrong way that day, though. Yeah. Short number of generations because there's a huge amount of variation in dogs, and what people have done with it is then taken that variation and, like, inbred them. And we've got Chihuahuas and inbred them, and we've got Newfoundlands. But Chihuahuas can still mate with Newfoundlands, and if you've met a male Chihuahua, you'll know that's true. Because they will certainly try. Guess why? Yeah, because their grandparents are their parents. Or maybe their brothers and sisters are their parents. Yeah, there's a bunch of things. Because we're breeding just for body shape, there are a whole bunch of things that do get reinforced because your mother is your grandfather and your aunt. They call it line breeding if we're breeding pedigree dogs. Humans call it inbreeding and go, ooh, yuck! And that probably means I haven't talked inbreeding at you either, so I'll... The blue few gates from Troublesome Creek, which I mentioned again today because Mr. McKinney was looking for the methylene blue. The blue few gates from Troublesome Creek we'll get to. Probably sometime before the end of June, shall we? So, yeah. The thing we need to know is that genetics is a big topic. It's a big topic, and we're going to have an array of choices about how we do assessment in it. The assessment's obviously going to be a little bit later than it says in the course outline. That's just life.